are now listening to The Brian Callen Show, rated the number one podcast of all time.
Of all time.
Oh.
Make sure you're ready, because this is the podcast where you are guaranteed to learn virtually everything.
We are sponsored by Hover. And basically, Hover is domain management made simple. All right, it's the quickest way to establish and buy a domain name. You can do it under 5 minutes. And if you've ever registered a domain, you know the companies just try to upsell you stuff you don't need. I don't know if that ever happens to you. It's like, you want this? You want this option? No, I don't. I just want to do this, please. I just want to buy one domain. Thank you very much. And here's the best thing about Hover. They have a no-hold phone policy. You don't hold. You just get to somebody. It's fantastic. So if you ever run into a problem, you just call Hover, and a real live human being will answer the phone. Ah! Sorry, I'm getting excited. And by the way, you can get a .com domain, but guess what? You can also get a .net domain, which is totally underused, all right? So I always forget that. I'm always looking at .com, but in fact, you know, you can use a .net. I know a lot of people that are doing it. So I say, do it. It's easy. It's a pretty popular choice. And it's got lots of domain names available. So if you try for .com, go to .net. It might be available. Very important. And by the way, they also offer Google Apps. You can add Google Apps to your domain. Basically, you get everything you already love about the full suite of Google's productivity apps, Gmail, Calendar, Drive, Docs, the whole package. You already love and trust Google Apps for Gmail's 25 gigabyte storage and collaborating with chat and file sharing. I don't know if you know this, but Google is a huge company, so you can be, you know, they can be a little hard to get a hold of with your questions and concerns and support needs and things. But that's the best part. You get everything you love about Google Apps, but with the outstanding support of Hover. They make it easy, man. So I say it's a great solution for businesses. It's a very good company. Hover.com/Brian, B-R-Y-A-N, that is. You'll get 10% off. Come on now. Let's get back to the show. All right, this is the Brian Callen Show, Dermot's. And we have
still too
the
loud,
big
Brian.
Man, Mike Callen, calling in. Mike, Big Mike Callen is calling in. It's my father. Back by popular demand, man. Every time I'm on the road, anytime I'm anywhere, I always get requests. When's your dad coming on, dude? That was my favorite. That dude is awesome. He's becoming a huge part of my stand-up, by the way.
Apparently, your fans sound slightly Arnold Schwarzenegger.
That's exactly right. I like my gallon. Do we have the man on the phone? Big Mike?
We have him. We do.
There
oh, my
is.
God.
Whoa.
Listen to that voice. It's like the voice of God.
That man's got a strong, strong voice. He has a big cavity,
yeah.
As it were.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I read this book, The Sports Gene, and I inherited a lot of your slow twitch fiber, Big Mike, and none of your strength. So thanks a lot for that. are you calling us from your estate?
Yes, I am. And I just got back from San Francisco, so I am here for a few days before I go back to Los Angeles, where I believe you live, don't you?
I do live there. Do you think you'll have time for your son or no?
I think that we should plan that well ahead of time.
Oh, wow. That's crazy.
I don't see any reason why we can't spend some quality time in 2014.
Wait a minute. In 2013, this is crazy.
I know. You know what I'm thinking toward the latter part of 14. My calendar is looking clear at that point. However, I do have a lot of time set aside for your children.
That's what I'm talking about.
And your wife is.
That was a very inappropriate.
Yeah. Prima Nocte, Big Mike.
Yeah,
Prima Nocte.
You know that in our apartment we have a beautiful picture of Amanda right on the mantelpiece, and people come in that don't know her, and they take one look and say, God almighty, where did she come from?
Yeah.
And then I explain my relationship with your wife. I don't say much about you.
Yeah.
It's not terribly believable.
Yeah, I just I don't like the way your voice gets lower when you talk about my wife.
Yeah.
It's getting very creepy. Your wife. Whenever somebody says that, your wife.
What is going on?
Well, I am still trying to get famous. That's not working out so well. I suspect it won't work out. But I podcast and I do stand-up comedy and I work out and I play with my kids. So all of those things are there.
You know, and I was in a meeting yesterday with a bunch of federal government officials, details of which we won't go into, but we were doing a little small talk. And I said, yeah, my son's in the TV and movie bill. Oh, really? Really? I said, yeah. What's his name? What's his stage name? Brian Callen.
Silence.
What? Brian Callen.
No, you got to hold up a headshot.
No. It's spelled with not Ryan. Brian.
Yeah.
It's spelled with a Y.
I know.
So we get deeply into that, and then I say, look, has anyone here seen Hangover? Yes, that was a great movie. Which one was it? Was he the groom? Which one of the four guys was he?
Yeah.
And then I say, Hangover 2, he fired the gun, and at the end he was walking down the stairs.
Great description of my work.
Yeah, and then the subject moves on.
Yeah, he was in Hangover 2. He fired the gun and then walked down the thing. Thanks a lot.
Oh, he must have been in Hangover 3.
I was in another movie at the time called Ride Along, which is going to be a big blockbuster. So thanks for all the support. No wonder I'm such a mess.
Listen, I'm there for you.
I know.
I appreciate that. I have always felt that at least, when it's time for me to go to that podcast in the sky, that I'll have an opportunity to leave you with a few dollars. Until, that is, the latest bout of stock market decline, which means that little bit of largesse has gone away.
Well, I guess this podcast is over. No use for you now.
Yeah, I guess it is.
What is your take on this government shutdown, and is this a fight within the Republican Party? Is this an extreme element of the Republican Party not willing to play business as usual? And what's going on?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. It all goes back to the gerrymandering of these districts across the country, and particularly in places like Texas, where you've got a totally safe district for one party or the other. And as a result of that, it's really changed a lot. And you can't really envision the Republicans losing the House in 2014. Now, that for me, given my predilections, is not a bad thing. But what happens is it isn't so much the general election that politicians fight over, Democrat versus Republican. It's the primary. And the primaries are where, so if you, for example, in a particular district, let's just take the one I'm sitting in right now, here in Utah. If you win the Republican primary, you won the congressional seat, because the majorities for Republicans here are 60 to 65 times. It's been over 70%. So you got a lock on it. But to get the Republican primary, that's where the extreme views rule the day. Mm-hmm. And their incumbents are challenged by the extremists. I'm not as scathing about the Tea Party, by the way. They're not a bunch of rednecks. It represents a popular uprising in response to the expansion of government. The problem is, and I talk to a lot of these people, and I sit and scratch my head and wonder, that they're willing to do almost anything to get the enemy. And the enemy here is, you know, it's very reminiscent for me, being so much older than the rest of the audience, I remember very well the discussion in school, even grade school, of the communist, capital C, and how evil they are, Stalin, and how he kills people. That all happens to have been correct. But the tenor of those conversations and the absolute animosity towards another segment of humanity, which happened to be the Soviet Union, it's very reminiscent today of some of these right-wingers' animosity toward the administration, Obama and Harry Reid in the Senate. So this polarization is a result. I go back again, and you know, I haven't seen anything in the press about this. The gerrymandering, it's the primaries that count. And so they'll do almost anything, because you can nuke the enemy if it's Stalin. Yeah, there's going to be some collateral fallout. So they will shut down the government, and they consider that a victory. But coming up here on October 17th, the United States government can no longer borrow legally, and it has a $30 billion balance. $30 billion to any one of us would sound like a fortune. Problem is, on any given day, they have a cash flow over $100 billion in and out. So they can run out of cash in a big hurry.
And what happens now, then?
All of the payments the government makes, including Social Security, servicing its debt, paying off maturing securities, paying its employees and all that, comes to a sudden screeching halt. And that being the case, I'm not going to predict the implications because we have never experienced this before, and I'm not as arrogant as many of our pundits that say, well, it's no problem or it's the end of the world. Somehow we're going to have to try to find a way to muddle through. Like, and you've got to be careful.
And by the way, when we say we, really what we're talking about is...
is the country as a whole.
Well, and also the most vulnerable segments of the population. Head Start programs.
Social Security payment stuff.
Children who don't have anybody to take care of them when their parents work and
yeah, and you know,
the
interesting thing about it, let's jump back for a second when John Kennedy was assassinated. We're coming up to the 50th anniversary. And I remember it keenly well. Anybody my age or may even a little younger remembers where were you when you heard about that. At that time, Lyndon Johnson took over, and he called together all of his cabinet heads, and they came out of the room shaking because Johnson was determined to keep the federal government's budget down below $100 billion. I remember that like yesterday. And that was only at that point about 12% of the total GDP of the country. Now we're talking about 25% of the GDP of a much larger economy.
So the U.S. government is a huge part of the U.S. economy.
Yes, and it was never as entrenched or as important to as many people. Now, those people wouldn't suddenly die of heart attacks when they didn't get their money. They'd do what we all do. I'm sure I'll get a phone call from somebody and say, I don't get Social Security. Can you help me out? And obviously, I'll help them out. And will millions of other people, and we'll find a way. By the way, and that's why I'm saying let's be very careful about forecasting what's going to happen. You remember the sequester, right?
Yeah.
The sequester was a deal that the Congress cut with Obama, and that deal said that if certain things don't happen, we're going to suddenly and automatically reduce spending. Now, when that – and during the debates, the presidential debate, Mitt Romney said, you got yourself into this mess – and how do you get out of it? And this sequester could be very bad for our economy. And Obama said that's not going to happen. That was at the third debate in Long Island. And when I heard that, I said, wait a minute. You have no control over whether that happens or not, in fact. Well, in fact, it's happened. And when coming up to the deadline, now it's not anything like as big as October 17th. Nothing like that. But nevertheless, it was about a 10% cut in discretionary expenditures.
Explain what that is.
Well, entitlements like Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid are written into the law, and they're not discretionary unless you have Congress pass another law with the president signing.
Yeah, those are law of the land. They go out no matter what. And discretionary spending
is just part of the landscape right now. Discretionary is where the military is going to buy a new system. Some government department is going to put in a new information technology. You know, a thousand different things. By the way, that's a smaller and smaller and smaller part of the government's budget.
And maybe should be a bigger part.
Let me put this in parentheses before I finish this sequester thing. Going back again to Lyndon Johnson, you can go long after that. We could go all the way up to Jimmy Carter. The discretionary part of government, you could have a legitimate debate and say we shouldn't be spending this much, we shouldn't be putting people on the dole. That has become much, much less relevant because no president or Congress, unless they do something extraordinary, which is very, very improbable given the politics of the nation, can have any impact over where most of the money is being spent. Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security are the big ones, and now we have Obamacare. So a very, very large part of the total wealth of the country is now being spent and administered by government, and there's all kinds of problems with that because I will tell you the opportunity for fraud And the evidence of the amount of fraud is astounding, but you would kind of expect that. But I don't want to be an extremist on that. But let me just finish the point so we've got a closure. The sequester. The president and left-wing members of Congress were standing up every day on TV and saying, this is the end of the world if this goes through. The Republicans have to cave. Well, it's now been in place for a month and a half or more, and it's almost, again, part of the landscape. We've all adjusted to it. You didn't see any impact from it. I didn't. If you happen to be in the National Park Service, certain parts of your budget have been cut. You've had to reduce some staff. Same thing with air traffic controllers, but then because we didn't want airplanes meeting each other at 30,000 feet, there was an immediate special act by Congress to take care of that so they didn't have to furlough these guys. But my point is, and this is the general point I'm making and I feel strongly about, the people that want to control everything in a Washington or even in a corporation feel that with their control, everything will be okay. And if they don't control, everything goes to hell. Well, the truth of the matter, history tells us something quite different. And that is that of the billions of people, if you will, having lived, you have too with me, in various countries, you've seen this in different forms. Whenever something happens, people adjust. They adapt. They adapt to it.
Yeah.
There's an excellent book by Nigel Lawson, who was a former chancellor of the Exchequer in the UK and a very intellectual person who I've had the opportunity to talk to. He wrote a book, and it was called An Appeal to Reason, and it was about global warming. And he felt that the policy recommendations in response to global warming were crazy and couldn't help but do more damage than they could do good. And he said, if I accept the global warming argument, which, by the way, has recently seriously been called into question.
Well, global temperatures have stayed flat since 1998.
15 years. And, yeah. And some of the explanations.
And that's according
for that,
to the Intergovernmental Panel.
According to the Science of Measurement, which is done mainly by an organization in the UK.
Yeah.
So people are having a little difficulty explaining that. I got an explanation recently, which was so discombobulated I couldn't understand it. It was incomprehensible. The point is, try to get the American public to give up more of their earnings and more of their freedoms because of an imminent threat, which doesn't seem to be exactly at the door, despite all the predictions to the contrary. But going back again to the point, that I find that it's very difficult to be an Al Gore in today's world, thank God, because what happens is the evidence keeps coming in that if something happens, as Nigel Lawson's books points out, if something happens, people adapt to it. Free, intelligent human beings take measures to adjust to it. Mm. And you don't need a central coercive authority which sets up a new ministry of global warming, which will never, ever go away.
Will it stop global warming.
No, it might even make it worse. We've got plenty of evidence to that. But let me just say this. One thing you can be absolutely certain of, death taxes, and if you set up a ministry or a secretary or a department of global warming, and we suddenly had an ice age come back so that we all had to have our heat turned up high in July, the Department of Global Warming, with its 20,000 employees and its budget of $20 billion a year, would continue. It would continue. And the reason for that, and the reason that's happened throughout the history of the United States government, is that you suddenly hire 20,000 people. They have a vital interest in keeping their jobs and growing their jobs. And they become very, very active lobbying Congress. You and I just go on living our lives day to day. We don't have time for the Department of Global Warming or the Department of Agriculture or the Department of Energy or all these things that Jimmy Carter felt were so necessary to the continued survival of mankind. But we're not going to spend the time these 20,000 people do. They're the ones who are going to make all the campaign contributions and do all the lobbying in Congress and do all
well,
the...
Well, there's also a private enterprise cottage industry that grows up around these things. That
of course.
Profits off of them. So now you've
I said, I've said on these conversations before, when we lived in Potomac outside of Washington and we joined a golf club, I don't remember ever teeing up my friend, and this was a golf club you had to have money to belong to and to maintain it. I don't ever remember teeing up a golf ball to start a golf match and introducing myself to my fellow players that I hadn't met before, who were not lobbyists and who did not, when they would invite us for cocktails or something, did not have a very spacious, well-appointed home.
And they didn't produce anything. They basically just lobbied the U.S. government.
They produced legislation.
Remember that Montgomery County, where we lived in Potomac, Prince George's County, Fairfax County, which is all these bedroom communities around Washington, D.C., have the highest per capita income in the United States. Now, whoever designed that?
They don't produce anything we buy.
They produce influence.
Yeah. They produce influence.
But see, how many of us have the time to worry about that? We hear it and we say, gee whiz, that's really bad, and go on with our lives. That's one of the downsides of democracy in general.
Well, for the most part, the federal government for a long time has in many ways been rather ineffective and somewhat paralyzed before this. And states have stepped in where the federal government was not. I mean, there are a lot of states that have had their own sort of internal revolutions and their own ways of dealing with a lot of problems.
The states have been marvelous. I just sent a donation to Scott Walker in Wisconsin. There are a number of governors around the United States, by the way, not all Republicans, who have been very responsive. And it probably has something to say when you're smaller and have to respond to the people look at California. It's so damn big, you've got the same problem you have with the United States as a whole. But I think that the states have been leading the way here for a good period of time with experiments and all that. And that's where all the resistance to Obamacare comes from. You know, the Supreme Court decision on Obamacare is considered a general victory for the administration. But there is one part of that decision that said you cannot make an expansion of Medicaid at the state level mandatory, which was part of the bill. And they said that's unconstitutional. You can't tell the states to do that. Immediately, you had a number of states, including the state of Virginia, by the way, that said, we're not going to expand that Medicaid. And we think there's enough fraud, 25% fraud in that. We think it's a big piggy bank for the greedy to dip their hands into, the what we call the rent seekers. We're not going to do that. And you have 22 states now that have taken that position.
They're not going to. So they're not going to expand their own Medicaid programs because of fraud and because
it's been such an incredible burden on their own budgets, and because they give the feds too much control because the feds share in the amount of money that is put there.
So they basically want to secede from that. They basically want to take care of their own health care.
And the Supreme Court gave them the authority to do that. See, the federal government said, you got to do this. You don't have any choice. And the crowd in Washington, I mean, see, you've got well-meaning people and certainly intelligent people in Washington who have a different view of the world, certainly than I do, and certainly than Edmund Burke does. And I've said on this several times, read Russell Kirk's The Conservative Mind, which is a classic, written in 1953. Now, it's a hard read. Assign that, you know, a reading on your reading list and spend the year on it, because if you read 10 pages every week, you're probably doing fine, you know, but I think it's worth reading. But he goes through the history of conservative thought with Edmund Burke and all of those. And there are things that many of us, even somebody like me, doesn't agree with. I mean, he doesn't chastise the world for its for slavery, and I think he's got too much emphasis on religion and the spiritual for my taste. But he also says that societies throughout history have had a place for aristocracies and elites, and they've had a place for tradition, and tradition is very important. And the world has not been kind, the history of the world has not been kind to central authorities forcing people to do it their way because they think it's better for the greater good. And you get a lot, you know, there's a lot of people in the White House today who would not agree with that.
Yeah.
They think that if you set up a massive program, but when you put the evidence
Setting up of the massive program at the end of the day is really at its root about socializing equality. It's essentially about figuring out a way to level the playing field from on high.
And now, leveling the playing field is a treacherous slogan, by the way. You and I have talked about this before. When you say somebody says, I want to level the playing field, and you peel back that conversation and get into your third level, what you discover in one way or another, they're saying, I want some of what he has got.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's always what Milton Friedman always talked about. There's a big difference between equality of opportunity and equality of outcome.
Right. You know? And what you're seeing now more and more is equality of outcome is what people are seeking. And the only way they can do that is to take it away from those who have, you know, been successful.
The thing is that the internet, I feel like at least the internet, which is the last frontier, that is the America. The Economist, I think, talked about that too. That's the America that works. We still at least have commerce that is by and large unregulated by, you know, the federal government.
But are we going to settle for that? I think the point is that there's a trajectory to societies, right? And what Big Mike is talking about in terms of rent seeking, that's something that settles in. I mean, Manker Olson, who, you know, talked about that a lot. He was an economist. But he's got a great quote. The incentive to produce is diminished. The incentive to seek a larger share of what is produced increases. That's what happens over the course of societies, and I think that's the problem is that, you know, there is more and more of this rent-seeking behavior. There are lobbyists.
You know,
this
book, The Sports Gene by Dave Epstein, which I recommend to everybody, we're going to have him on the podcast, but that book is a good example of how nature certainly doesn't create an equal playing field. There are just some people that are born with stronger bodies, more linear bodies, more testosterone, whatever it might be. So it seems to me that you want to – the fact of the matter is competition and meritocracy is really what it's about. I do think that we do have issues of discrepancy and equality in this country. Of course we do. I do think that there has to be some way we can get people in the inner city and people of color who don't have the same opportunities. We have to figure out ways to inspire better education, better nutrition, more access to the things that most of us have that were at least in this room.
But where does
so it... that's a debate. That's a separate debate. But it seems to me that at the end of the day, you certainly believe, Big Mike, that the U.S. government is not usually the entity one should turn to solve these kinds of issues that we all care about.
Look, age is useful, not for everything, for some things. I was there as a conscious adult when the war on poverty started, and I can't remember anybody being against it. John F. Kennedy, to his credit during his campaign, said, you know, I went into Appalachia and I saw people I never realized existed. These are people who were living for what they grow and eating what they killed. And if they weren't killing, they weren't eating. And how can this country, da-da-da. And there were great speeches that came out of that, and we all supported the motive. All right, let's fast forward now. I'm 73 years old. I'm looking back. I'm talking when I was 21. Now let's fast forward for more than 50 years. Okay. The other day I saw in the newspaper, and I was appalled, there are more poor people defined by the government than there ever have been, right now as we speak. Okay. Now, so that would seem to say we have made no progress over the last 50-some years. And if you then look at the numbers, you'll see that between state, municipal, and federal programs designed to fight poverty, we are spending on an average of $100,000 per year, per family of four, about 115 million families in this country.
Wow, that's a lot.
Well, we've got a vast, vast bureaucracy which has been set up to combat.
So the money goes to that bureaucracy,
not to the
people.
Now, if you are radical and you say, look, let's not cut taxes or stop spending, let's just send a check for $100,000 to every one of those families, and we have eliminated the poverty program. And then we can tell, I guess, several hundred thousand at least, maybe over a million people to go out and find something else to do because what they have been doing hasn't been working. You know, if you worked in the private sector all your life as I have, you get fired. I've been fired twice. Not pleasant.
So have I.
Made the adjustment. Yeah. And I like what you said one time, Brian. The many, many things you've said that I remember I've written down.
Thank you. It's called wisdom.
I collected sayings of Brian Callen.
One of your shows on TV was panned. You didn't do well. The Nielsen ratings weren't good.
Right.
And I said, not too bad. And you said, you know what I like about it? It's totally impersonal. It's totally fair. There is no politics.
That's right.
The people didn't like the show. And that's that. They don't know me. We haven't got any history together. there's no influence. Say, let me tell you about my Uncle Charlie, the kind of thing you do on Capitol
Hill. They just click the channel. There you go. There's
and I didn't
better.
Pay anybody to vote for me, you know, the way we do in Washington. Yeah. And the other field of endeavor that I enjoy for that reason is sports. Immediate feedback. And maybe you can have luck in one particular game, whatever sport. But over time, the best are going to win. And the feedback's immediate. There's no politics. There's no old boy network and all that crap. But when you get into the political arena, everybody builds a vested interest and goes for it forever. I want to tell you one quick thing along these lines, switching the arena a bit to foreign policy. Your mother and I took a trip with Madeleine Albright before she was secretary. And
secretary,
before Clinton
secretary,
was elected.
Clinton's we, secretary of state, everybody.
Yeah, yeah. We went through and the first female secretary of state.
Yeah.
She was a faculty member at Georgetown at that time, which I was on the faculty of. And we went through Eastern Europe and traveled around. We had the ambassador, U.S. ambassador to NATO with us and some other luminaries. There were probably about 20 of us. We went to Prague and saw where she lived as a young girl and all that. One of the people on this trip, now this is after the fall of the Soviet Union. The wall came down, the Soviet Union was in total dissolution. And the whole purpose of NATO was to combat the European threat that the Soviet Union represented with its massive land army and so forth. There was one guy on this trip who was sent by NATO, by the Department of State, representing NATO, and he was explaining to us at every meeting in every country why NATO had to continue. We cannot dissolve NATO just because the original purpose it was established has gone away. So, and you know, this is what government always is. It is so much fun to suck off the taxpayer, who is, by the way, anonymous, invisible, an abstraction. But we're getting all this taxpayer money, even if we have to wait for it and borrow in the meantime. And boy, that's fun. That's great. Now, the idea that we should go out of business is unthinkable.
Mm. Well, and you know, doesn't this all come back to money and politics and campaign finance reform? Like, as Lawrence Lessig, this book that we always talk about, Republic Laws, talks about, the idea that as long as it's about 130 fundraisers in Washington, and Washington will always be an economy of influence where good people behave in a corrupt manner. I mean, how do we solve this? How do we fix this issue?
You know, Brian, you can walk across I-95 in rush hour with a blindfold on, and there is some probability you'll make it across alive.
You're talking about in Washington.
If you're trying to, Thomas Jefferson said once, if you want to make enemies in Washington, change something, because there are so many vested interests, and it's much worse now than it was in Thomas Jefferson's time.
Isn't that a good thing in the sense that they'll cancel each other out?
Well,
No. It can be a good thing, but you see, this standoff, here is something to be very careful of. People will increasingly be saying now, we've got to get something done in Washington. And right now we've got one side in Congress that won't permit anything to be done, the other side in the White House and the Senate who want to do these things. We've got to get these things done. No, we don't. We do not need to get 95% of what they want to get done. We got all that stuff done. We got a Department of Energy, so of course we immediately solved all our energy problems.
What does the Department of Energy do, and when was it in?
Regulates the production of energy. What it was originally designed to do was really quite narrow. What it does now is everything. It's into absolutely everything. It's got a venture capital fund that primarily promotes and invests in renewable energy projects.
Right.
And as Larry Summers says, we're the government, meaning we're the crappiest investors in the world. The whole problem with government is there's no competition and there's no incentives. It's all a big managing up. I don't blame the people, but it's the natural structure. And the big problem we have with our president is well-meaning, intelligent, all those nice things. He has never had to compete. Think about it. And where he did compete in the university at Harvard and so forth, just try getting his transcripts. I mean, they're locked up in Fort Knox underground.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. No, nobody's ever been able to find his transcripts because there would be a natural desire. Was he a top 10% guy? Was he a really good student, but you're not going to get that information. And as near as I can tell, the only time he's had to compete on what you call a level playing field is when he was in those kinds of situations. Otherwise, as a community organizer, he was a speaker. He was somebody who would rally people, protest, listen to Jeremiah Wright and all that kind of stuff. And there was never any competition. Now, he did compete to become president, and that's one hell of a competition, and I'll grant it. I'll grant him full credit. But he doesn't know anything about going out there and trying to get people to come and buy your product when you've got somebody else trying to do a better job at a lower price.
So you would rather have a president who had to go out there in the real world as an economic animal and compete and win. I mean, that's like someone like, for example,
that's how I see the world's progress to have been realized. I see Western history as nothing more than the progress of human liberty.
Absolutely. But in the same way, even if you did have a person like that, let's imagine that you get this figure who has really had to go out and compete and sell and all that sort of stuff. Once you take that person and you put them in Washington with campaign finance, can they be that same person?
Or probably not.
Probably not. I think that's the problem is that incentive structure that's set up in Washington is going to poison even the best possible leader.
Yeah. And so therefore, I lower my sights, Hunter. And what I say is, before you pass a law in the name of, quote unquote, getting something done, whatever the hell it is you want to do, before you do that, take the Edmund Burke attitude. Remember, you will never, ever undo it. Mm-hmm. You are getting married. You know, mm-hmm. A relative of mine said to me a while ago, I want to hire so-and-so. And that so-and-so just happened to be a member of the family. And I pointed out, just remember, maybe you want to do that. But are you buying yourself a shipload of problems in case you've got to fire that person? Because it's mm-hmm. almost literally impossible to do. It's literally impossible to undo an act in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what the desperate Republican effort to do something about Obamacare, which they have a lot of popular support for, it's almost impossible to do that. Defunding it is just not, you know, no matter what Ted Cruz says.
Right.
And so, you know, and the other thing is, remember, and this is not a good thing, you into the situation we're in, where you have this polarization, and then you get somebody like Ted Cruz out of Texas, and he's just, by the standards we use to measure, not reasonable. He's an extremist. And you're giving the other side all kinds of ammunition. All you have to do is listen to MSNBC. Every time the name Ted Cruz comes up, which is often, they're just taking shots at what an idiot. And using him as an example of these crazies on the other side that you people have to fight to get out of office.
Mm.
It doesn't do any good.
Mm. No, you're not dealing with the substantive issues.
Mm.
And now, Big Mike, let me ask you. So there's the immediate, obviously, what's going on right now, this immediate situation. But what do you think is the sort of, if you look back from John F. Kennedy going through the present day and going forward, say, 30, 40 years, what trajectory is this country on?
Well, it's on a trajectory right now to become a European social democracy where government does 50% of all economic activity. Now, when people point out, and I was at a debate on this subject, in fact, participated, that's not the end of the world because you're not talking about a Marxist state and so forth. And they use Germany. Well, look at Germany. It's in that position. We are not Germans. If we were all Germans, there would be some validity to that argument.
Right.
We're not Germans. We are an incredibly diverse population. We've got communities which have not made a whole lot of progress. Charles Murray, with his astounding book, Losing Ground, made an excellent analytical argument that the African-American community has not been served by the federal government. In fact, a lot of the progress that was being made stopped cold when a lot of these programs were put in place.
A little anecdote to that. Mr. T, who does a lot of work for charity, and I was at this children's charity thing, and I saw him in the supermarket, and he's really a great guy, you know, from Rocky. And he said, he was telling me a long story. He said, well, my father couldn't stay around in the household because, you know, they told him to leave because my mom would make more money from the government if he got out of the house because she was a mother with dependent children. So he left.
Exactly.
And he said that happened a lot. And I was like, wow. Well, you know, you get well-meaning people, and of course, I probably would have been one of those people saying,
sure,
you can't have poverty. You know, when I was in Baltimore, I was like, we got to do something, man. The issue is, what do you do? You got to be very careful with what you do.
Sure. And
they might have made a difference, by the way. Some of those programs did make a difference. So, you know.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah, but I mean, you look at the history of what has aid done in the developing world. You know, I mean, there's a lot of it disappears into that bureaucracy. I mean, there are all those stories about aid that tried to go to Afghanistan, and
it comes back to a philosophy: do the poor or those that are in need, do they need more bread or do they need inspiration? Right? Teach a man.
We have to be careful about sound bites, but here's a great one from Milton Friedman. He said, if you pay people to be poor, you're going to get poor people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And right. Look, there is a certain incentive to remain poor because of the numerous programs we've already talked about. And I was at one point in my life poor. And at today's level of support, all of which you could make great speeches about, and to make speeches on the other side, you don't sound very good, and you're going to get booed. But the reality can be something entirely different. I'm not entirely sure I would have busted my hump, except your mother would have made me with a whip. But I'm not entirely sure I would have busted my hump so much if the living standard I could have maintained doing very little work, and I am very close to some people in this situation exactly today, if I had been receiving in one form or another the kind of support that's available. I mean, if your life, it's interesting to me because what you want to do in life has something to do with the vision you have of the potential in life.
Of course.
If you would want to go out and travel the world and see the animals in Africa and the monuments in Europe and all that type of thing, then the support you get from public sources isn't going to do it for you. On the other hand, and I was at this point one time, your life, and I know people at this stage right now, your life doesn't go beyond your flat screen TV with the sports events that are played on that throughout the year. And by the way, the system is feeding you more and more as it expands the number of games. And now you might note, if you're an NFL fan, they now have Thursday night football, so you don't have to wait so long from one week to another.
Thank God.
Monday night football and five games simultaneously on Sunday and all this stuff. So you can absolutely surfeit yourself.
Yeah, which I have a feeling you do, but keep going.
No, wait a minute, Brian. I got to go. Got to cut this short.
Yeah, exactly.
The NFL line.
Hey, you've got an appetite for football.
But it's seductive. It's very, very seductive. By the way, wise ass, I'm retired. But it's seductive. It's very seductive.
Yeah.
And I know people that I have never received any communication from them that wasn't about their favorite team, whether it won or lost, and then you're joshing back and forth. And the sports bars are filled with these people. So if that is the extent of your perspective, of your aspirations, then these government programs are just exactly what the doctor ordered.
Mm-hmm.
But that's insidious because when it wasn't available when I was a kid.
I mean, come on now. You're indicting sports fans, for Christ's sake. That was a terrible example. For God's sake, just because a man likes football doesn't mean he works hard, doesn't work hard.
But anyway, am I permitted a rebuttal?
Yes, you are. Yeah.
Sports fans, about 90% of them, I'd say, are hardworking folks that have rounded a spectrum of activities in their lives, but sports is a fun part of it. One guy yesterday I was working with who struck me through the meeting we were having is very analytical and very smart, very much with it. After the meeting, we were saying goodbye to each other in San Francisco, and I happened to mention, he said, they see that building, if that building were taken away, it's just going up now, but you could see the new baseball park in San Francisco. And I said, yeah, well, it's the Giants haven't done very well this year, so who cares? he went into about a five-minute detailed analysis of the teams, the strategy, the trades they should make. Here is a guy whose life is what he does in business very successfully. And in the course of our meeting, it was clear that he has other interests and does other things. But he also had sports part of his life.
But isn't that sort of team loyalty one of the things that sort of paralyzes Washington as well? Aren't we now? And I'm on this side, you're on that side, and that's just the way it goes. I mean, is this really a battle of ideology, or is this a battle of?
Well, you know, there's an interesting phenomenon that happens. You get elected, you go to Washington, you're full of fire, you're an ideologue, you hate the way they run this place and so forth, and come back 3 years later, you're one of them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's exactly right. And really then, you know, I think the challenge is to figure out a way to, and I think the internet may very well be the answer to this. You know, I think that technology may very well make it likely that there are candidates that are going to be able to run for office. Maybe not, you know, the big chairs, but at least, you know, local office and things, and it'll start there. Who become very good at developing and creating their own constituency through various mediums, like say even a podcast or whatever. I could never run for politics. Too many skeletons in my closet. But there, I really do think, and I hope that we no longer, as people, when we want to run for office, are beholden to the sort of fundraisers and the infrastructure that exists in Washington and in state capitals. I think that technology is going to liberate us from that problem.
But
if you
look at, I mean, what, you know, one of the arguments that often is made about campaign finance is that, you know, some of this regulation that has meant that you have to rely much more on small donors means that you therefore have to spend that much more time fundraising.
Of course.
And, you know, if you look at the sort of donations that are coming in over the internet, they tend to be extremely small.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I have a friend of mine from college. She's running for political office, and I get a million emails from her every day about this and
that's not an effective way. And so the answer then is, There will be, right now, that's probably why it's not happening. I think that there will be a time when it becomes very easy to essentially get your message across, pure and unadulterated, and develop enough, at least, momentum to run for office and get elected.
Brian, here's a question that I muddle around with, and you're going to get all kinds of nasty feedback. So I'm asking a genuine question. I met somebody about 2 months ago. In connection with a charity I work on. And this person struck me as uninformed, what we would call a low-information voter. And I suddenly, I don't know why, but I asked this person, I said, well, what do you think of the vice president? What do you think of him?
Didn't know who it was.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Didn't know who it was. Now, here's
I live in LA. That's the norm.
That particular person has access to the internet. All the information's out there.
Yeah.
I would be very surprised if this person can read beyond comic book level, and we're talking about somebody in their 20s, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, how much you make information available and how much they go and take is two different things. And my question is, should that person who doesn't know Joe Biden's the vice president
be allowed to vote?
Yeah.
Well, you know, everybody talks about this in their, at least within their own mind. I mean, I spend enough time in this country traveling. I meet some fantastic people, and I always say that I'm always surprised at how smart and how informed actually somebody from what you'd call a flyover state is. They know a lot more than I do in a lot of instances, especially in how it pertains to their own life. However, you also meet another segment of the population that shouldn't be allowed to vote,
because they're so
ridiculously uninformed. But at the same time, that's not the democracy. It's certainly not what the founding fathers. Although the founding fathers is a little murky because they said you had to own land. But the answer is if you believe in democracy, and you have to allow everyone to vote. Here's why. Yes, somebody may come in and be, you know, physically look terrible and be just sort of this, whatever. But you have no idea how much they actually know. There are a lot of people that you know, it's basically the danger of judging a book by its cover. There are a lot of people that don't have a dime, who are slovenly and who are, you know, who may not know who the vice president is, but they have some wisdom. They know exactly what it's the difference between right and wrong. They have a sense of fair play. And so if you made me emperor of the world, the temptation would be to say, you can't vote, you can. I do think there's merit in asking voters at least to take a 10-question quiz. But then you have to ask yourself, who writes up that quiz?
Yeah,
and,
Brian.
And how relevant is it?
Right? You have to ask yourself the last time in American history where we had a test that you had to take in order to prove your eligibility to vote. How did that work out? It's called the literacy test. It's called Jim Crow laws.
Yeah.
The point is that, you know, how do you decide who knows what? How do you decide what standard do you use?
Yeah.
The point is that somebody maybe not have the actual facts, but they have a good read on whether that's a fundamentally decent person or not.
Of course. I've run into many, I travel the country, a manual laborer who maybe hasn't read any books, but is in a lot of ways a lot smarter than
Absolutely.
I am.
Absolutely.
And that's the danger. I am definitely not, you make me the emperor, and we all, like everybody, I think I have answers for lots of problems, but I don't want to take that responsibility. The one thing I've learned is that I believe in democracy, and I believe in the fact that there is a wisdom to crowds, and that this thing, this messy thing called the democracy, the Constitution, this is messy. But at the end of the day, I think it probably works better than any other system.
Well, and I think it goes back to what Lawrence Lessig said in Republic Lost, quoting from the Federalist Papers. The point is that the government is supposed to be accountable to the people alone.
Mm.
And the problem is that they're not just accountable to the people. They're accountable to the lobbyists. They're accountable to the people that they raise money from. They're accountable to
That's
a whole bunch of people.
That's the problem.
Absolutely. It's graft. It's corruption. It's not being responsible just to provide. I mean, I think, you know, what Big Mike has talked about is competition, right? And to bring that back to sports, right? You have a referee there to ensure the best possible competition, right? You can't bring a gun on the field, right? And, you know, you also don't want so many rules that the whistle is being blown every 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And the point of the government is to provide an environment, a field, where competition is maximized.
You asked a question one time, Big Mike, about that I loved, which was, and it comes from a book, and I can't remember what you'll tell me. Who would you rather be ruled by, the Harvard faculty or the first 2,000 names in the Boston phone book?
That's a William Buckley postulate.
If you believe in democracy, you have to say the first 2,000 names in the Boston phone book.
And you're probably wiser for doing so.
Yeah. Yeah. So the answer is I'm afraid I have to grant that person in his 20s who might be a moron.
If you want competition, don't get tenured professors from any university.
Yeah.
Because once they're tenured, they don't have to worry about competition. They become terrible teachers. My whole life experience is every time you see somebody who doesn't have to compete, you see a deterioration in performance. And that seems logical to me because the motivation disappears and so forth. So if you really have to compete hard and you're allowed to lose, but as long as you can lose and you live another day to come back and try again, which is, again, the model. The business model of sports franchise. So long as when you lose, Stalin style, you're not shot and you disappear. With, you know, losers, it's life and death. It's not supposed to work that way. And a lot of people that have failed in business, for example, I've said this before, people underestimate how many failures there are in business. They look at the big successes of Jobs and Gates and so forth and say, look, those guys shouldn't be so rich, shouldn't make so much money. You don't understand that there are about 1,000 people that have tried and tried and tried again and have never been able to get over the hurdle. And that's a good thing as long as they keep trying. Mm-hmm. Now, I have invested quite a lot of your money, future money, in various ventures. And every one of them has failed. And they all sounded great to me.
I hope this podcast takes off.
And I am not doing that anymore.
Send your money to 1-800.
There's a little something left, Brian, a little something left. So if you can push me under the bus, you can accelerate.
Believe me, I'm coming to visit soon.
Yeah, I know.
Now, let me ask you, but if I were to make you, and this is always such a silly question, but I love these questions. If I make you emperor of the United States for one day, I mean one year, give me the first things that you would change. How would you do? And if you could, you may not be able to do anything.
Day one, if I didn't have to deal with a whole bunch of vested interest, I would reform the entitlement programs so that a guy like me, for example, does not get Medicare, does not get Social Security, and some of the other programs, which I do not get deductions of my mortgage interest. Now, I wouldn't say, okay, guys, as of tomorrow, this is all over. I would phase that in over a 10-year period, nothing less than that, because the economy and the society has become so structured around these realities of today that it would be unfair and, I think, unworkable. You know, it's interesting. I just finished Catherine the Great by Robert Massey, which I would recommend to anybody, not even so much because you really want to know a lot about Russian history, which may be something most don't care about, although I think there's a lot of instruction in all history. But one of the things that was interesting is we think of czars and czarinas, especially back in the 1790s.
Czars and czarinas were basically the absolute rulers.
The autocrats of Russia. The emperor. She was the empress. Empress
the word Catherine. Czar comes from Caesar.
Yeah, Catherine the Second. And good insight, Hunter. Now, she wanted to change the serf system. She had a very good dialogue for her entire life, her entire reign of 35 years, with Voltaire in France, with Diderot, who came to visit her. And out of all these conversations, these great European intellectuals, she came up with a rather massive constitution she actually wrote herself on how to revise and restructure the serf system, which nobody today could even believe existed, whether owners had the right of life and death with no recourse to the serf over any one of them.
They were chattels, they were owned.
Yeah, just basically, even worse than our slavery.
An indentured servant, or was a serf a slave, basically?
No, they were total slavery.
Wow,
they
really?
Were owned.
They couldn't leave the land. They were
Right. Yeah.
Wow.
And Tolstoy found out how difficult it is to get these people to free themselves even when they were given license to do so. But that's another subject. Catherine wrote this thing up and sent it to her. They actually had parliaments and dumas and so forth without a lot of power. But when she was attacking their vital interest, which was the serf system, she could not have sustained her position on the throne trying to push this through and signing a law. He didn't have that authority. So what I'm getting to is, you said if I were emperor of the United States, and what would you do? I wouldn't do things that I think in the long run are going to be good because I have a total authority. There is no such thing. I'd be overthrown. I'd be shot. My house would be burned down. People are not going to – numbers count. You would be dealing with hundreds of millions of people who are being disserved or being injured badly. And people resist injury, and they'll do anything. And we've got a history full of monarchs who were assassinated, including a number of czars and several of our presidents. So you don't do it that way. That's not real. But I would, over a 10-year period, means test all of these entitlement programs and make people like me pay their own way. And by the way, I wouldn't necessarily reduce or eliminate the taxes I have to pay into the Social Security system, because a certain amount of progressivity is a good thing. But I would also reform the tax code. That would almost be the first thing I do. And I would introduce a flat tax. I've seen very good studies done by two think tanks that would demonstrate that a flat tax is going to increase total revenue to the government. But I wouldn't have to do that if I reformed the entitlement program. And I would be autocratic in getting rid of all the special interests. I mean, I just would. Remember, I wouldn't have to deal with a Congress. And I don't think that an autocrat, I would only want that job for maybe 15 years. And then I would want to go back to the system.
I said again. A year, for God's sake. Where the hell did you get a 15 years? I'm not making
you
the emperor.
No, because if you only do it for a year, none of this stuff's going to be implemented.
I'm not. Listen, man. You just
made me the emperor of the United States. Show some respect.
Yeah, you did. It's got under your head.
My stuff. How about your imperial majesty?
He wants 15 more. He wants 14 more years. I give the guy a year, and this is he wants 14 times the power
now.
You
give me a finger. I want your hand.
I was going to say. mean, what an example of how power corrupts.
Absolutely no sexual innuendos.
Even Big Mike is corrupted with one question. Think about those Washington politicians. Big Mike, as always.
And by the way, my deal with the government is that I would have two things that would be paramount. One is I would prevent monopolies. And two, I'd provide for the security of the country. That would be pretty much. I would not get into the economics and how it's structured and take over industries. And the auto industry in this country would be in a very different position if I had been in that place. I'm not going to deem or coerce different structures on the economy. I don't think we necessarily have to make cars that are better than other cars.
What about banks?
Banks have to be regulated as long as you're going to guarantee deposits. That's what I was doing in San Francisco. Let me just tell you a little vignette here. I was in San Francisco because I've been asked to join the board of a bank because they need independent directors who are not ambitious and who can't be bossed around by the CEO. So they got three of us, and I was honored to be asked to go into that. And we went to the FDIC in San Francisco, the regional office, with about 10 people from Washington on the phone. And the people that were proposing and sponsoring this, some heavy hitters here in the U.S., made their pitch. And one of the guys from the FDIC, and I was proud to hear this, frankly, he said, Mr. Blank, there's one problem with your application here, your proposal. You are asking the United States government, the FDIC here, to take on additional liability and guarantee the deposits that you would take, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole reason you're here. Yes, yes, of course. What are you doing for the public? We understand what you're doing for your particular customer base. We understand what you're doing for you who owns the place. What are you doing for the public? What is it that the commonweal gets in return for the government issuing these guarantees? I tell you, that was one of the most refreshing statements.
I love that question.
That's why those guys are there. You know, that's very different from my experience with elected officials on the Hill. Mm. I loved it. So we've got to go back to the drawing boards and come up with a different proposition.
Wow.
That's the way regulation is supposed to work.
Yeah, that's good regulation right there. I appreciate that. That's good stuff. I like that. I'd like to get one of those guys on the podcast.
And I overheard one of the chief FDIC guys. I don't know if he knew I was listening or not, or I was within earshot. He said, are you sure you're going to be able to live with Callan as a director? After a two-hour meeting.
That's it. That's what I'm talking about, Big Mike. I like that you, when I asked you when you were available, and you said, we worked out a time and a place. I said, let's shoot for Thursday morning. Before we had you on here, and you said, I remain your humble and obedient servant.
As always.
Yes. Yeah, until he's Emperor of the United States.
And then he wants 15 years. I give the guy a year.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Well, I'll tell you, I'll take the year because with autocratic authority, I'll simply elect myself or appoint myself.
Yeah. You see what happens?
Say it's a time of crisis, you
my
know.
God. Da, 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 yeah. My God. Yeah. You know what? He's way bigger than Napoleon, but he's got the same mindset.
It's a crisis.
Big Mike, I want to thank you for joining us. Once again, you are, as always, still the most popular guest on the BCS.
Listen, I'm in love with your wife.
Well, Jesus, this is getting very awkward, man. And now you're the emperor, I guess she's yours.
I love taking her around and showing her off because when you're here and we went to that music party and things, I always get people that say, geez, your daughter-in-law is really gorgeous.
Yeah, I know, and you take credit for it. You say, yeah, I'm a wealthy man.
Like the old monarchies of Europe, I selected her for my son.
That's exactly right.
The way to do
it. Well, you know what? If nothing else, we've outed you as a true a closet monarch.
You don't have to have any doubts about that.
That's what I like
the
to
only
hear,
way
pal.
To go.
Thanks all for
right,
all,
guys.
Thanks for all the invite.
Thank you so much, Uncle Mike.
We'll talk to you later, pal.
Take care, guys.
Later. Awesome.
Always.
Big Mike, as always, the man.
Rolls deep.
Rolls deep, man. He rolls deep. I'm going to do the Joe Rogan podcast, everybody. So I'm going to be talking about this podcast. I'm a man's podcast. All right, everybody. Love you.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit briancallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Callen and like him on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/Brian Callen Comedy.
Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.